Greetings to the crew of the Gaia Navigation Experiment, to friends and allies scattered across time and space, and anyone else who cares to listen. This is your navigator, John Lash, recording a briefing on September 9th, 2012. The title of this briefing is The Celestial Anchor. It's a Sunday morning here in Andalusia, around 11 o'clock, a beautiful autumn day. You can feel the beginning of the fall season as the air cools. The heat of the summer broke last week during an agonizing period of about 7 days when the wind blew constantly. It was one of those Mediterranean winds that are notorious for driving people to insanity or suicide. I had to spend a fair amount of time approaching the fetal position under a sheet in the darkness of my room, my bedroom downstairs. It really got to me. Generally, it blows for 3 or 5 or 7 days. And this is the first time it had blown for 7 days, pretty much from the 2nd to the the 1st to the 8th of September. So at that moment, the summer heat broke. The nights began to be very cool. You can feel some moisture in the air. This is also the moment, by the way, during this week of buffeting winds, strong buffeting winds. There were massive fires north of me in the area of Marbella, Coin, Ohen, and some of the other larger towns, larger white villages on the other side of the Sierra Bermeja. So the Serranía de Ronda and the Reed Valley, where I live, were not affected by these fires, but they were tremendous. And driving from the airport, you can see them very clearly, how massive amount of acres have been scorched black by the end of summer fires. So that's a little bit of local news in case you were wondering about me and whether I was safe. Safe I am, and I wish to you safety and safe passage in the remainder of our experiment until March of 2014. As I've suggested already a couple of times, I'm certain we are going to find that the second half of the Gaia Navigation Experiment feels hugely different from the first half. There are a number of reasons for this, of course. It's obvious that we're more experimented and savvy. We've got our sea legs now. We understand how the process works. Even those of you who are uncomfortable with astronomy have perhaps been able to get the feel of the lunar apogee and perigee moments. You've been able to watch the sky a little, catch the crescent moon at sunset, follow the magnificent display of Venus and Jupiter throughout the skies, evening and morning, during the course of this year. Of course, the main event of 2012, of which the world, apart from our crew, knows very little or nothing at all, is Pleromic Relay. And it is the installation and full operation of Pleromic Relay that makes the great difference in our experiment as it now unfolds. As I continue to brief you from this point on, I'll be referring again and again to the theme of the central riddle of correction. I'll approach this theme from various angles and propose to you how to frame it in your understanding, how to question the theme, and how to develop a more and more sophisticated syntax. many, many things, many immense realizations, touching the foundation of your personal reality and resonating all the way out through the collective to the very cosmic identity of our species, are coming now, imminently, constantly, day by day. Because as of about 48 hours, pleromic relay has been completed. Now, I want to point out that I've already slipped the term post-relay. That's kind of a misleading term. One crew member, Kath in Texas, wrote me questioning that. Do I mean to say that relay was set up between June 16th and September 7th, and relay was operating during that time, and after September 7th, we're in a post-relay period when it's not operating anymore? Certainly not. That is not the case. So let me clarify. Between June 16th, 2012, when Jupiter reached the degree of the Pleiades, which is 61 degrees of the ecliptic, or 1 degree of the sign Gemini, and September 7th of 2012, when the apogee of the moon reached that same point, a momentous event took place involving the Earth, the Moon, the Sun, the entire planetary system, and the dynamics of the galactic system all the way to the galactic core, or the Pleroma. As I pointed out previously, there's been an enormous amount of talk going back to the days of José Arguelles and the harmonic convergence of August 1987, a tremendous amount of talk about galactic alignment. You could say that José Arguelles introduced that meme, and then it was rapidly taken up by hundreds and hundreds of other people, most notably people like John Major Jenkins, writing on Mayan cosmology and Mayan cosmogenesis. And as I pointed out, and of course, galactic alignment is a huge topic in the genre of New Age spirituality, channeling, and New Age metaphysics, all of which we do not follow here in the GNE. We do not follow it because it is speculative, it is metaphysically abstract, and it cannot be verified. Nevertheless, the buzz is on about galactic alignment and has been so for a good many years now. And I'm happy to point out that you and the crew dedicated to this experiment and those others who may be fellow travelers with us, could be passengers, could be people who are considering coming on board, those others who hear my words and have been integrating these briefings will know that they belong to the very select, or I should say self-selecting, company of people who have a particular understanding of galactic alignment. Unfortunately, most of the astronomy taught in connection with galactic alignment is incorrect. It is simply incorrect astronomy, or it is astronomy that has been skewed to fit a preconceived agenda of what alignment might be. Even John Major Jenkins, at one point, much to his credit, admits that there is no indication of a precise galactic alignment at the moment of the expiration of the particular Mayan calendric system that was inaugurated, I think, around 300 BC and commemorated on the Tikal Stela. No, he even points out that you cannot make it that precise because there is a window of alignment of about 200 years stretching up until 2200 AD. So, and furthermore, it is he's be commended for having self-corrected himself in that manner. Furthermore, the idea that the Earth is somehow aligned to the galactic center in a unique way in December 2012 is totally incorrect in astronomical terms and makes no sense at all in any given model of celestial mechanics. The alignment of the winter solstice of the tropical framework of the Earth to the sight line of the galactic center is an actual astronomical event, and that alignment is due to be exact around the year 2216. And when that alignment occurs, it marks the end of this kalpa of 26,000 years and the turnover of the cosmic clock from the midnight hour, which is 2216 by the current Christian calendar, to the next day of cosmic timing. Now, this larger framework, the time frame of the kalpa, is also important for our experiment, as you know. I've proposed the space-time conversion of one day of terrestrial time to one kalpa of eonic time. So for the Aeon Sophia, who is an aeon from the galactic center, 26,000 years is one day to her. It is one day of the experiment that she is living, embodied as the imminent divinity of this planet. One day. And that calculates down, as you know, to 108 days of terrestrial time as we humans experience it, being equivalent to 1 second of her time. Correction takes place in 10 seconds of her time, or about 1,080 days, or about 3 years of human time. So the larger celestial or kalpa time frame is really important, because we see that Sophia awakens to the conditions of the experiment in the last 11 minutes of her day, and that she makes her correction in 10 seconds of those last 11 minutes. And what proceeds from the moment that she has completed the conditions of correction in March 2014, what proceeds then is the complete manifestation of those conditions of correction. So we in the Gaia Navigation Experiment are witnesses to the initial conditions of correction in that 3 year or 10 second interval. And at the very midpoint, where we are now, the midpoint will be, let's say the exact midpoint will be September 19th, 2021st of 2012. That would be 18 months into correction. At this midpoint, something has been completed, which no one of us, including your navigator, anticipated or previsioned at the outset. But as the experiment unfolded, it came within the range of our perception and the range and the frame of our conception to realize an event taking place in real time as it was taking place. As you know, the first moment that your nab got the glimpse of that event was in the spring of this year, as I observed the Venus-Jupiter conjunction from the viewing deck of the Turton's house here in Andalusia. At that time, many people around the world were looking at the glorious spectacle of Venus and Jupiter having a date in the western sky after sunset. And it was remarkable that this occurred in the constellation of the Bull, with the bright cluster of the Pleiades prominently displayed in the configuration, in the beautiful celestial dance of planets against the background of the stars, the semi-eternal lights of heaven. At that moment, by living imaginatively and mythopoetically in the very presence of those celestial omens, I was able to glimpse the event that was to come. Then, by looking closely at the astronomical data, at the ongoing progression of the lunar apogee in relation to the movement of Jupiter from the ram into the bull, I was able to navigate and plot or chart the course ahead. And so I indicated that relay would occur in the time period I just described. Now, I should not speak of post-relay because we are not in a post-relay period since Friday. We are in the period post-installation of relay. But relay itself is permanent, and relay is now completely installed in every single aspect of the 21-point cable setup, every single aspect, including the dedication of those 5 cables to channel 16. Now the moment has come to actually use Pleiromic Relay, to see how she uses it and to use it ourselves. And this will continue for the next 204 years until the end of the Kalpa. So I would want to take this moment to share with you my astonishment and my excitement. It's almost an unspeakable excitement, and also a certain sense of relief. I want to share with you at this moment the fantastic sense of privilege that must be felt by everyone who has this intel. This is not just information, folks. This is not just more information pouring out of the information grids of the planet. This is supreme intel regarding the life of the planet and the intentions of the wisdom goddess herself and the designs and purposes of the planetary animal mother. Now, you know, this is a phrase I've used quite a bit. Going back to even a little before the Gaia navigation experiment kicked off, I introduced this phrase in some email correspondence I had with a small group of 5 or 6 people at that time, labeled the Shakti Nexus. And that Shakti Nexus was the humble seed of what very quickly burst into full blossom in the Gaia navigation experiment. And I remember in particular once talking to crew member Holly, who belonged to that group, when she was here for a brief visit. And 2 subjects resonated very strongly in our conversation at that time in the spring of 2011. One of them was that you realize your connection with the earth when you admit that you have no life of your own. Therefore, your biography, your story, your personal history, your sense of who you are as an individual person, although it is not invalidated, is subsumed into the greater narrative of her story, and you realize that your life story means nothing without hers. Just as you cannot possibly breathe another breath unless she supplies it to you imminently, at the moment you take it into your lungs. Likewise, you cannot continue in your life story as a viable member of the human species unless you incorporate your life into her story. So Holly and I talked about this, and I know she took that message deeply to heart and carried it to other people. In addition to that, I said to her something that I repeated numerous times in the following months. The purpose of this experiment is to realize and fulfill the designs and purposes of the Wisdom Goddess herself. Now I want to tell you something I consider to be so beautiful and so wonderful. The fact is that although we can look at nature and see how it works, we can look at the way trees grow, the way the oceans work, the tides, the way butterflies migrate, the way animals behave, the way microbial entities behave, such as slime mold, which is vividly featured in the parable of the beast. We can look at all these phenomena of the natural world and learn from them about her designs and purposes up to a point. But what we have yet to learn is what I would call the transcendent and overarching objective of the great symbiosis of life on this planet. It's one thing to observe the symbiosis of life, and we absolutely must observe that to have any sanity or viability as a species. It's one thing to observe the great symbiosis of life in the planetary habitat and to admit the place of the human animal in that symbiosis. And it's another thing to extrapolate that into the transcendent objectives of this whole experiment on her terms. You know, my friends, my crew, me mates, we don't even know yet what that is. It has not been put into language, but it's coming. It's really coming, and it's coming soon, and it's coming fast. Remember, her way is fast and vast, and it's coming deep, and it's coming in permanence. And this is what comes in the second half of the Gaia Navigation Experiment if you stay on board and remain dedicated to finding your life in hers and keeping your story and everything you know in the frame of her story. Remember, that is the story that guides. No individual, no religious teaching, no master, no mastermind, male or female, guides in the way that the story guides. The story is the guide. The story is what tells us as anthropos what are the designs and purposes of the Wisdom Goddess. And up until now, no one has known this since the time of the Teleste. And what they knew, as we know, was lost and destroyed. So I just want to impress this on you as a preface going into this NAV briefing, which is number 24. I said the celestial anchor. Let's call it celestial anchoring. The Earth is now secure in celestial anchoring through pleromic relay. Just imagine that. That is the most vivid and voracious concept of galactic alignment that anyone could ever propose. And just imagine as well the opportunity that we now have. I am pretty certain that we are surpassing the Telestai. We've already begun to surpass them, what they knew in their intimacy with the Wisdom Goddess. I am pretty certain that we are surpassing them and can surpass their expertise to a very large extent. I am also certain that they had in their time and setting a pretty comprehensive idea of her designs and purposes in this higher transcendent aspect that I'm pointing to now, this higher transcendent aspect of seeing the purpose of the experiment even beyond the beauty of its symbiotic success, even beyond the beauty of its biodiversity and the magnificence of the autopoiesis of the planet and all living species, even beyond that, seeing her objectives, seeing what she considers to be a success for her experiment. Seeing all that now would be to see what the Telestai knew and then some. And then some, my friends. And even though I'm convinced that they knew a lot, the time has come to recover what they knew and double down, go one better, and know even more. Now, it is a fact of history that what they knew about the designs and purposes of this experiment conceived in the Pleroma by Sophia and Thelete and witnessed by all the Pleromic aeons, what they knew of this experiment was without question profound and far-reaching. And there is no doubt that they had the syntax to transmit what they knew and to teach it in the mystery schools. But the record of history tells that what they knew was so dangerous to the psychopaths and archontic human beings, obsessed with power and control, obsessed with hijacking the experiment, that the Gnostics and all the records of their teachings had to be entirely eliminated. So I just want you to realize and take this to bed with you every night when you lay your head on the pillow, that the visionary knowledge that you are acquiring in this experiment is the most dangerous information on this planet in regard to the agenda of the interspecies predators and the globalist psychopaths. The most profound and beautiful intimacy with her objectives is also the most dangerous knowledge possible on this planet. It is what will make you really a dangerous animal, with the understanding that you are not dangerous to other animal species and not dangerous to other animal humans, but that you are dangerous to those who intend harm to the web of life and those interspecies predators among humankind who prey massively on the human race and use evil by proxy to achieve their insane vision of planetary domination. And if the tide is going to turn, and if the balance of human experience in the scales is going to shift from advantage to the perpetrators to advantage to those who are good and decent animals, this is the moment it happens, and you are at the core of that shift. You are at the core of that change of fate of humanity itself. This is where the Gaia Navigation Experiment is taking us. So with that said, I'd like to concentrate the remainder of this briefing on the current celestial factors. That is to say, on the navigational factors. I am, after all, your nav, and that is my self-elected task. What I'd like to do with you in the remainder of this briefing is to recount for you what I perceived and how I built a perception over the last few evenings as I watched the pre-dawn sky, observing the positions of Jupiter and Venus relative to the background of the stars at that very moment when pleromic relay was finally completed, at that very moment when relay became fully operational. Now, I believe I did a briefing sitting out on the terrace recently. Was it moral anarchy or evil by proxy? I think I spoke of you of sitting on the terrace in the pre-dawn. Let me remind you that the period in which pleromic relay, in which the installation is complete, falls within a Dakini shift of Shodashi. And I know that not all of you can follow these Dakini shifts. It takes some practice, and it's not always easy to detect the mood of the shift or to pick up in your subliminal mind stream what might be a motif of Dakini instruction. Sometimes it comes in a flash. Sometimes it's less obvious. Especially when there are a lot of other things going on, when we're anticipating the opening of Channel 16, when we're anticipating a lunar apogee or perigee moment, these events occupy our attention. They engage the first attention, which includes the simple power of observation, and they engage also the second attention, which is the power of imagination. And so when you're engaged with those in those ways, which is, of course, how you practice this experiment, it's not always possible to pick up on the subtle and fleeting frequencies of the Dakini shift. But I would say that throughout this shift, which began around the middle of September, excuse me, around the middle of August, throughout this shift, I felt inklings and intuitions of the great beauty that is now due to emerge as the effects of pleromic relay become obvious, as they become evident. What, you know, a good part of the experiment as we proceed from now on is just going to be asking day by day, well, what is the difference? How is life going to be different? How is it going to look different? How are the events in my personal life, or the pattern of my own personal destiny, as it were, how is it going to be impacted by relay? How is my life going to be enhanced? How are my relations to the world going to be changed now that pleromic relay is fully operational? You can ask that question. We're going to live with that question in the Rilkean sense, moment by moment and day by day, from this point on, intensely, until the spring of 2014. And I can tell you right now, one thing that is clear to me, and it was clear from the initial moment of this shift when I did a shamanic seance with another crew member here in Andalusia, I can testify that from that moment and throughout the shift, the sense of the sovereign and ineluctable power of beauty is absolutely palpable. her designs and purposes and her objectives for this experiment, whatever they may be in a tangible, specific, and concrete sense, are all about the achievement of the highest beauty of which a human animal individual is capable. And it is about the highest beauty of the individual animal. Whatever could be built in the form of a beautiful community of people, a beautiful society of people, a beautiful nation of people, whatever could be developed by our species along the lines of those larger frames of cooperative human behavior has to be based and anchored in the single and sovereign freedom of the individual and the beauty of how you live your freedom. Freedom is beautiful, but freedom is not free. And that is why you must be a warrior to claim your freedom. And it must be claimed from the predators and the psychopaths who hate it and who wish to strip it from you. So the life of the warrior is a life in the line of beauty as well as a life in the line of duty. And I have felt during this Shodashi shift what some of you also who are writing me have felt, the beauty of human connections, the beauty and simplicity coming back into human connections. And in some cases, I would say too, or I would speak of one specific instance, speaking of myself here, of a beautiful opportunity that was lost. And I had to grieve the loss of this beauty, of the beauty of another individual who came into my life and brought beauty, the beauty of herself, of her intelligence, her talent, her taste, her delightful, girlish flair, her youthfulness, the exquisite beauty of a human animal at the point of its greatest maturity of flowering at the age of 42. You know, Grand Cru Dakini, age 42. And that beauty lost. So this will happen as well. We converge now in beauty with each other. That is the connection, to be beautiful together and to do all that is beautiful. And in some cases, that beauty will slip away. In some cases, as Rilke said, we will have to live the tragedy that we feel when a good thing falls out of our hands, when something falls away, due to no fault of anyone, but probably just due to the unsustainability of human illusions and to the simple fact that the ego cannot receive. And along with beauty, there is a range of emotions that support and nourish us as human animals. And foremost among those is gratitude. And anyone who cannot feel gratitude for the opportunities that life now presents in the frame of planetary tantra is not going to be able to sustain themselves in this experiment. So you will see people go. You will see beauty lost. And there is a tragic feeling about that. But at the same time, there is so much beauty to be gained and enjoined through our hearts in this moment. And what secures that beauty in our hearts is one simple and supreme emotion, gratitude. So I would say that it's no small matter and certainly no coincidence, unless you want to call it a cosmic coincidence, a cosmic synchronicity or a feat of synchromysticism, as the popular meme would have it. There is no small significance in the fact that pleromic relay and the anchoring of the Earth into the core of the galaxy happens in the Shirdashi shift. And it looks like we're due for a second shift of the same Dakini. The current shift ends on the 16th of September at 2:11 a.m. Universal Time. And the new moon at that exact moment is in 24 degrees of Virgo, which actually is in the tail of the lion. Now, this is really unusual. This is one of the anomalies that you get in this fantastic sequence of Dakini shifts, which is never the same. The sequence of Dakini shifts is not programmatic. It is supple. It has always unique and remarkable variations. So normally, the new moon that marks the end of the Dakini shift would fall in the constellation of that Dakini, the constellation of Shirdashi being the Virgin. But this falls about 6 degrees from the head of the Virgin. And so it's remarkable that the conclusion of this Shirdashi shift links back to the Lion constellation and perhaps recalls a resonance or teaching from Bhairavi and from the warrior aspect of Gaia, Durga, the Kali aspect of Gaia. Immediately following the conclusion of this shift, we have on the 18th of September the crescent moon in the evening sky conjunct to Saturn, and it is actually going to occultate the star Spica. And then on the 19th of September, the perigee of the moon is aligned to Kambalia, the alchemist star. This would be a momentous kickoff of profound species transmutations that would only be possible in a relay situation. That is to say, that we can anticipate seeing events intended by the wisdom goddess, specific events of transmutation of the human species that she could not have achieved until relay was totally operative. So we are looking at the kickoff of the next Dakini shift, which would again be a Shirdashi shift. Two shifts in Shirdashi, two shifts in the Virgin are not that uncommon, as you know, because the Virgin is a large constellation spanning 45 degrees of the ecliptic. But we can expect to see a spectacular kickoff in the second half of this month. Now let me tell you about what I've been observing over the last 4 or 5 days. I've been out there in the morning before dawn, and of course often the moment I step out, the sky is still very black, the moon is waning, has been waning, so there's less and less moonlight diffusing through the sky, making the stars more visible. The Milky Way has been brilliantly apparent. And often when I step out, Jupiter is already a good notch above the eastern horizon, and I see the spindle of the Pleiades positioned above Jupiter. Then as I sit out there on the terrace, looking east, I watch the constellations rise. Orion rises to the right of Jupiter, to the right and below. And to the left of Jupiter, there is Perseus with the star Algol representing the head of Medusa. So I'm reminded of the Perseus-Kalki avatar and that whole part of Gaia's narrative, of Sophia's narrative, which has yet to be fully revealed. Also, just below the constellation of Perseus, which is Kali Kalki, there is the constellation of Auriga. The brightest star in Auriga is called Capella, and that is identified as the glittering kid of the mysteries. Auriga, the chariot, or charioteer star, charioteer constellation, is a loose pentagonal composite. And one of the stars belonging to it, we know, also is shared by the constellation of the Bull. So the star that marks the horn tip of the north horn of the Bull, El Nat, also belongs to Auriga. El Nat, let's recall, is identified with the power of the Aeon Telete. And then beneath Auriga, who might be equated with the Grail King in some respects in celestial mythology, rises the constellation of the Twins, with the two bright stars, Castor and Pollux, marking the head of the Twins. Now, I would point out something to you, that when the lunar apogee, which is currently in the Bull, passes that region marked by the head of the Twins and shifts into the Crab, which is a dim and vague constellation beyond the Twins, we will have arrived at March 2014. And it is a fact of celestial navigation that I'm happy to share with you, that the conditions of correction are complete when the lunar apogee passes Castor and Pollux. Now, how appropriate is this? If you go read Constellations of Words, which is a website that has star lore on it, or if you read Star Names, Their Lore and Meaning by R.A. Allen, which was written in 1899, and which is widely excerpted in the on the website Constellations of Words. Go read about the Twins. Go read about Gemini, and you will find that the stars Castor and Pollux have been held sacred to navigators and mariners from time untold. And how appropriate is it that those two guardians who have watched over many mariners who have sailed the oceans of this planet, the oceans and the seas of this planet, those two same stars form the gateway to the completion of correction, the completion of the initial conditions. How wonderful is that? Note also that Castor and Pollux, for some reason, have been associated with the phenomenon of St. Elmo's fire, which is an electrical discharge of plasma in the masts and rigging of sailing ships. And I propose to you that by the time the lunar apogee reaches those stars, that the planetary animal mother will have configured the electromagnetic field of the planet right out to the ionospheric belts in such a way that she has brought in the Birkeland currents and the plasmatic currents in the upper atmosphere into integration with the lower atmosphere. And it may well be that just as sailors witnessed the play of St. Elmo's fire in the mast and rigging of their ships, we here on Earth may witness the plasmatic electrification of the atmosphere by Sophia as a result of what she is doing in correction. And that from March of 2014 onward, from the spring and summer of 2014 onward, the human species, or those members of the human species who are capable of attaining and sustaining that perception, would see the atmosphere in an entirely transfigured manner. And I want to point out to you that much that is happening in the atmosphere now that may be wrongly attributed to human meddling could be attributed to Sophia's own modifications of the atmosphere, especially her response to the over-ionization of the atmosphere and the over-electrification due to the massive installation of archontic telecommunications devices. This is something to anticipate. The understanding of these phenomena and sorting out what she's doing and what is actually done by human meddling, such as geoengineering. This is something to be learned and realized in the immediate months to come. Such were my thoughts, anyway, as I was watching Castor and Pollux rise on the left side of my perspective of the eastern horizon. And of course, by the time Venus came up, Castor and Pollux were there, off to the left of Venus. I could see the two head stars very clearly. Around the 5th and 6th of September, Venus dropped down through the twins and passed into the crab. It's moving very rapidly through those constellations. Now, I'd like to tell you in very close detail what I observed in those days of the first week of September 2012 and how I arrived at what I would call a sidereal epiphany, something portrayed in the sky for all to see, but something only to be seen by those who have the training and the patience to observe it. The best way I can do that, I think, is to use two illustrations, which I'm posting with this NAV briefing. The first one is a screenshot from Stellarium, and the second one is a sketch I made based on that screenshot. So first look at the screenshot and follow the details in the screenshot as I describe what I saw over the last few days in the pre-dawn sky. Or more precisely, what I observed and imagined simultaneously as I was gazing at the morning sky. First of all, on the screenshot here, you'll see two lines. The red line running slantwise across the page is the line of the ecliptic, that is to say, the orbital plane of the Earth. And most of the planets and the moon as well move above or below this ecliptic line. So you can see that Jupiter is just below the ecliptic and Venus, the large light at the lower left-hand corner of the screenshot, is also close to the ecliptic. And then the other line you see, the blue line, is the so-called celestial equator, which currently is located pretty much in the middle of the constellation of Orion. It does seesaw up and down due to the shift of the polar axis of the Earth relative to the heavens over a period of thousands of years. There again, that famous Kalpa cycle that I was talking about earlier. But right now, the celestial equator, which is an imaginary projection of the equator of the Earth into the heavens, crosses the belt of Orion, as you can see. Now, some stars are named on this screenshot from Stellarium. And this shot was taken, by the way, September 9th, this morning. And at this particular time, we see that the star Venus is just passing from the constellation of the twins into the constellation of the crab. But if you were to wind back a couple of days, you would have noticed that Venus was sort of lined up with Castor and Pollux. You can see the star Pollux, the lower head in the figure of the twins. And it's indicated by Pollux, but they haven't written Castor, but that is the name of the other bright star above it and to the left. And if you were to draw a line through those two stars down to the ecliptic, that would be where Venus was positioned a couple of days ago. And when I was watching it a couple of days ago, I noticed that. You could say that the passage of Venus through that alignment brought my attention to that alignment in a particular way. But at the moment that happened 2 days ago, I didn't put the whole picture together. I just noted that there was an alignment of Castor and Pollux that somehow figured into the overall perspective I was seeing. It somehow figured into the overall composite of stars, but I couldn't quite figure out how until I saw something else this morning. Now, set that detail aside for the moment and scan your eyes over the screensaver and look at the upper part of this configuration. You see that the star Aldebaran is indicated there. That's in the eye of the bull, the constellation of the bull. And there's a small, tight cluster of stars close to Aldebaran, which is called the Hyades. The configuration of the Pleiades, by the way, is at the very top center of this screenshot. It's cut off a little bit, but it just looks like there are just two stars up there. But that is the Pleiades, that mark at the very top center. And the Pleiades are normally pictured as being somewhere on the back or hump of the bull. Jupiter, of course, is the large sphere located in the bull here, and it's really between the two horns of the bull. You can see the two horn tips of the bull. If you scan to the left from Aldebaran, you go down past Jupiter and you come to that one horn tip. That is, of course, Elnat, and you see how it forms the lowest part of the constellation of Auriga, which is marked by the bright star Capella, the glittering kid. If you scan down below Elnat, you see the star that marks the southern horn tip of the bull. And that star, we know, is connected with the Aeon Christos. And we also know, I've pointed out before, an important detail, that the Crab Nebula, one of the most mysterious objects, or perhaps the most mysterious object, in the whole local region of the galaxy, visible to us, is located very, very close to that star marking the tip of the southern horn. So you see the general frame of Taurus being a large V with Aldebaran at the apex and the two horn stars at the base of the V. Notice how over several nights I seemed to see a large structure taking shape before my eyes. The various alignments of the stars were brought into a particular formation, that is to say, the stars took on a certain alignment before my eyes based on the way that Jupiter and Venus were positioned against the background of the stars. If I had just been observing the stars without Jupiter or Venus present, I wouldn't have noticed certain things. I wouldn't have automatically visualized certain things. But that is, in fact, the way it happened. I found myself visualizing a kind of antenna. And the image that came to mind was sort of like a whip antenna. What I saw was that the top of the antenna was marked by the Pleiades. And then it came down to Jupiter. And then it came down again to another star, which is at the feet of the twins, actually. It's to the left of the star Betelgeuse, and down slightly. That's a prominent star at the feet of the twins. And then it came down to this star Procyon. And if you follow that, you'll see that it makes a kind of a whip that is bent slightly, bending to the right. And so I thought, gee, that's funny. I wonder if the palindromic relay has something to do with a whip antenna. And then I found my observation continually drawn to the crossbeam of the whip antenna, which is, of course, formed between Aldebaran and Elnat, with Jupiter more or less at the center, although the distance from Jupiter to Elnat is slightly more than the distance from Aldebaran to Jupiter. So what I experienced as a spontaneous visualization as I was observing these positions was a whip antenna with a slanted cross beam at the upper part of it. And I thought to myself, that's funny. I wonder why I'm seeing that. As a matter of fact, if you trace with your eyes, you can probably reproduce how I saw that. Trace a line with your eyes from the Pleiades down to Jupiter, down past the star marking the southern horn tip of the bull, down to the star at the feet of the twins, down to the star just above Procyon, and down to Procyon itself. And you see how that forms? A perceptible curve. So the cosmic configuration was suggesting to me this curve, a whip antenna with a crossbeam in the upper part. But there was something about that that also didn't fit. There was something about that that didn't work for me, because another more powerful visualization was emerging from behind it. And until this morning, I couldn't see what that other visualization was. My attention was drawn again and again to the angle of the crossbeam of this alleged antenna, the slanting angle depicted by the Aldebaran-Jupiter-Elnath alignment. And time again, I looked at that slanting angle and I thought, what does that remind me of? It reminds me of something that I've seen. But what? I couldn't place it. I couldn't bring it forth in my imagination. But as I continued to observe night by night, the starry sky itself brought it into my imagination and directly into a clear visualization. Another factor which contributed to this dawning visualization was the rising of Sirius before Venus. Now, if you look again at the bottom of the screenshot, you'll see that Sirius is off to the extreme right. And then coming left from Sirius is the star Procyon, which marks the head of Canis Minor, or the lesser dog. Sirius itself marks the head of Canis Major, or the greater dog. And it is, of course, the brightest star in the sky. So I was struck by the fact that as most of this, the greater part of this configuration, was standing above the horizon, and there I am waiting for Venus to arrive at the last moment. She's taking her time putting her makeup on. And as I'm waiting for Venus to appear, Sirius comes up. Well, first, of course, Orion comes up. And then Sirius comes, the dog following Orion, according to traditional celestial legend. But then I noted, from my viewpoint, looking at the hillside to the east of my house, that Procyon arose in a horizontal line leftward from Sirius. And a couple of nights ago, when Venus arose, she was in a perfect alignment with Procyon and Sirius, and that caught my attention. And again, the observation I was making of the sky with my first attention was building a visualization in my second attention. It was building a visualization of a concrete image in my second attention as I was observing with my first attention. And as I just noted, in the emergent phase, in the initial phase of this visualization, I pictured a whiplash antenna with a slanted crossbeam in the upper half, but I knew somehow that that was not, it was not satisfying to me. That visualization somehow didn't work. And especially when I looked down at the bottom part of the total configuration, I could see that somehow the pattern taking shape before my eyes was rooted or grounded somehow in Procyon. And time and time again, my attention was brought to Procyon. Now, Procyon is a star about which I may have a lot to say in the near future. In any case, in this configuration, Procyon, which is not normally a star that one observes very much, it's, say, inconspicuous or elusive, it doesn't seem to really stand out or announce itself. But Procyon obviously played a key role in this configuration that was taking shape here in the dawn sky. And at first I thought, it looks like Procyon is the base of this whip antenna that is bent off to the right. But why would it be aligned to Sirius, or why would Venus bring my attention to the Procyon-Sirius alignment? And then why, a couple of days ago, would Venus have been aligned with Castor and Pollux? And what was that bringing my attention to? And then I realized, just this morning, that by making that alignment, Venus had brought my attention to a comparison between the star positions. You can make this comparison very easily. If you look at Castor and Pollux, the angle in which they're situated, and the distance between them. Now cast your gaze off to the right, which would be to the west, and look at Sirius and another star placed above and to the right of Sirius, which is Mirzam, or Beta in the constellation of the greater dog. So Sirius is Alpha, and above and to the left of above and to the right of Sirius is Beta or Mirzam. And those two stars sort of mirror or echo Castor and Pollux. And then if you picture that mirroring, you see that Procyon is very closely centered between the Castor and Pollux coupling and the Sirius-Mirzam coupling. And so I thought, what does that look like? What does that shape suggest? And I couldn't quite picture it or bring it into a visualization. That is to say, the shape formed by those five stars with Procyon at the center or axis. In order to get the full visualization, I had to keep scanning my eyes up and down along the supposed axis of relay. I knew that the axis of relay proceeds from the Pleiades. So the Pleiades were indisputably the key point from which relay proceeds. Looking downward, I could trace a straight line to Jupiter, which is located at the pivot of that axis between Aldebaran and Elnath. That somehow forms a part of the relay mechanism. But then again, if you come all the way down, what do you have? You have Procyon very close to exact alignment between the Pleiades and Jupiter. Here again, let's recall that the Procyon is a star that doesn't move and the Pleiades don't move. Jupiter is a planet that's moving. But in its position at the moment of the completion of relay, it signals a configuration. It gives a message. It presents the visual information for the first attention to form a visualization with the second attention. What does it prompt you to visualize? Well, what I saw this morning, I saw for the first time in my life ever. It's something that we can all see for the next few months, because Jupiter is going to go into a retrograde cycle in its current position. And although it is going to move slightly out of alignment between the Pleiades and Procyon, it is going to return to that exact alignment. And so Jupiter is standing there against the background of these stars in order to give a pivotal point for a visualization. And what is that visualization? The top of it is the Pleiades. The pivot or axis is Jupiter, defining a slanted bar with the higher end at Aldebaran and the lower end at Elnath. There is a long extension from Jupiter down to Procyon, and then proceeding from Procyon to the left, there is an arced extension to Castor and Pollux, and to the right, there is another almost identical arc extension to Sirius and Mirzam. And what does that visualization look like when you take it out of the starry background and sketch it? It turns out to be a huge anchor. It's a very particular kind of anchor. It's an anchor in which the bar in the upper part of the anchor is on a pivot. And such anchors do exist. And that is exactly what I was trying to visualize several days ago when my gaze kept returning to that distinct angle formed by Aldebaran, Jupiter, and Elnath. I kept thinking, what does it remind me of? What have I seen? What kind of structure, what kind of artifact, what kind of object have I seen that has a long axis with that kind of tilted bar attached to it? There are certain kinds of anchors that have that pivoted arm in the upper part. And the lower part of the anchor is, of course, the standard anchor form of two branching arcs that reach out in opposite direction. And the hooks or hook end of those arcs are represented by the coupling of Castor and Pollux on the left and Sirius and Mirzam on the right. And there you have it. The celestial anchor, the omen of celestial anchoring that represents the completion of pleuromic relay. Now I ask you, how is any such event in the sky possible? In the sky and the human imagination at the same time. How is any such event possible? When I began this experiment, I proposed the nautical metaphor. And I think that you love that metaphor. I certainly do, and we can have a lot of fun with it. We can call each other mateys. There's the bosun, there's a first mate, and I'm putting out a call for a first mate, by the way. There are sirens who sing on the deck. There are drunken sailors and those who peel potatoes in the galley. There's the navigator, and there is the captain of the mothership, who in this case happens to be also the indwelling intelligence of the mothership. We all love the nautical metaphor. It's wonderful to play with, and it works. And we know that it is, in fact, voracious. It is a literal or functional metaphor. That is to say, it is not just a metaphor, but it actually provides a functional and factual description of the Earth traveling through interstellar space. So we began the Gaian navigation experiment by taking on the nautical metaphor. We proceeded for a year and a half in this experiment to a culminating moment at the midpoint. And how is it possible that the celestial omen, the celestial figuration of this moment is actually an anchor? Tell me how that's possible. If that's not cosmic interactivity, then I don't know what is. And this is just the beginning. But this is our moment. This is a moment to celebrate and a moment to honor and even revere the power of imagination in the Anthropos. The power of imagination of that magical child.